Welcome to Musings on Sports, where each week we hear great stories from men and women throughout the world of sports. I'm Kelly Elbin, along with my co-host and dear friend Bob Bupka. Bob, we've got the beginning of the National Football League season 2022 upon us, the first full weekend of a crazy weekend opening for the college football season has just taken place. But before we get to that, a tribute to a true titan in the golf industry who passed away over the weekend, Herb Kohler, who I know you knew well, whose Whistling Straits course in Wisconsin hosted three PGA championships and then the 2021 Ryder Cup, which the U.S. won in grand style last fall. He was quite a figure in the game.
Well, he certainly was that, Kelly. And I know you had contacted Joe Starinka, who had a lot of dealings with Herb Kohler. And maybe you can share that with our listeners of Musings. And then I'll tell you an interesting story about Herb and how all this kind of got underway.
Yeah, when I heard the news of Mr. Kohler's passing, I reached out to Joe Starinka. Joe was the CEO of the PGA of America for many years, and Joe is now the chief strategy officer for Starinka Sports and Strategy, with a simple question: hey, Joe, could I get a quote from you about Mr. Kohler, with whom he had dealt for many, many years very closely in putting together major events? And it took Joe about 5 minutes to get back to me with these lovely words: Herb Kohler has always been one of those figures who was larger than life, personally, professionally, and in golf. He was a man who could appear intimidating at first. His handshake was akin to arm wrestling. His eyes and mind were penetrating, searching into your soul. But his warm smile and big heart were alive and full of compassion and love. We in golf were fortunate to have him share his love and intellect with our game as well as our business. We all learned from Herb and will miss him dearly. What a figure he really was in the game. And it really was only in the last 30 years when an abandoned airfield that the Kohler Company purchased, he brought in Pete Dye, they built the Straits course at Whistling Straits, and the rest is history.
Well, the interesting part about Herb Kohler, it all got started when he decided, Kel, that he wanted to hold the U.S. Open in Wisconsin at Black Wolf Run, which is one of the other courses that Herb owned at the time. So what does he do? I mean, Herb Kohler thinks, well, why don't I just call the USGA and I tell them what I want, and the rest will be history. Well, so he got somebody on the phone at the USGA, and they were quite taken aback when he said, I'd like to speak to somebody about holding a U.S. Open on my golf course. Through a series of from one person to another person to another person, he came across somebody that could answer or respond to Herb. The gentleman said, what is it you would like to do, Mr. Kohler? He said, I want to hold a U.S. Open on my golf course. Well, the guy said, well, it's not quite as easy as that. I mean, you know, to be honest with you, first off, we'd have to see to even see the golf course and judge it on its merits. So he said, okay, tell me when you would like my plane to pick you up. And he said, well, he got taken aback. So he said, I'll get back to you. And then finally they contacted him and said, well, we're going to tell you, you can't hold the U.S. Open, but there is a possibility for a women's open. He said, that's fine with me. So the ball got rolling, and Black Wolf Run hosted the women's open. Siri Pack went on to win. It was in a playoff. And on that playoff, I remember standing alongside the first fairway, and I said, good golly. What is that? Here comes Herb Kohler down the middle of the fairway, right behind the two players with George Bush Sr. Okay, they were good buddies. And they were walking down the fairway behind every shot. And Herb Kohler, I had come to find out, if somebody in the town of Kohler, Wisconsin, had some financial problems, they could go to see Herb Kohler behind closed doors. And Herb would evaluate the need and then give out the cash. And with this statement, if things turn around for you and you can pay me back, that's lovely. But if that never comes to be, that's lovely too. So Herb really, as Joe accurately said, bigger than life. And it led to quite a friendship with myself and Herb Kohler. And so I definitely was saddened by the news. Just a super, super guy that, loved golf. I mean, he called to make a reservation to go to the British Open, and he wanted to stay at the Old Course Hotel. And he was told, his assistant said, "Sorry, Herb, they're all sold out." He said, "Well, call them back and see how much they want for it." They called back and bought the place, and then he was able to get a room. So Herb had a heart of gold. My condolences to his family, to the people of Wisconsin, because they lost a legendary figure with a heart as big as anybody you'll ever want to meet. Herb, I'm going to miss you, buddy.
Speaking of legendary figures, the great Dick Stockton is going to be joining us later in this episode of Musings on Sports. But back to Mr. Kohler, you really liked him. You engaged well with him on a golf level. I mean, he loved, I don't know that he played the game all that much, but he loved seeing what his properties, how it transformed Wisconsin, how it contributed to the game in unforetold ways, and really to be able to share that with the people of the state he loved and the game of golf, it was really important to him, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And, Wisconsin has become a golf destination. I mean, if you had said that 30 years ago, people would have laughed at you. But Herb Kohler had the vision, had the wherewithal and the dedication and made it get done. That basically was Herb Kohler in a nutshell. If he thought something was good, he would get it done.
Well, that's right. And you talk about two powerhouses. You put him together with Pete Dye's vision. And I'll tell you, Bob, the first time that I ever saw Whistling Straits, I was just blown out of the water. I mean, so many of the holes are right on Lake Michigan. Aesthetically, visually, it's unique. And I know that you've had Bandon Dunes out in Oregon that's been created since then. But the visuals of that place, the first time you've seen it, and you see it in some of the incredible holes right by Lake Michigan, the par threes and the par fours that go right by it. It's just spectacular.
Yeah, and when I saw it and I was doing my interview with Herb Kohler and Pete Dye, I said, Herb, you must have allocated quite a generous budget for this construction of this place. He said, "Oh, I gave him plenty, but he exceeded it."
See, Mr. Dye was known to do that. He was known to exceed the budget, but always create something memorable and extraordinary. And yeah, we've lost in Herb and Pete passed away a few years ago. Two real titans of the game. Hey, I know you are in Biloxi, Mississippi, and perhaps there might be some time spent at the gaming tables there. You are a good blackjack player, from what I understand. And I gave you a little bit of direction with the National Football League beginning this Thursday with the defending champion LA Rams hosting the Buffalo Bills Thursday night primetime game on NBC. Should be a terrific game, by the way. I like the line on Cincinnati at home getting 6.5 against the Pittsburgh Steelers, who haven't even named their quarterback as we record this. So, Bob, maybe take a little bit of your earnings from the blackjack table, go to the sports book, and put a little bit of money on the Bengals, please.
I will certainly do that. They have a magnificent sports book here. I'm at the Beau Rivage, probably the best hotel casino resort in all of Biloxi. Had a pretty good night at the blackjack table last night. Hope to accomplish that one more night. But no, you never know with blackjack. Sometimes those 21s turn to 22s in a blink of an eye. It's all a matter of You got to know when to hold them, and you got to know when to fold them.
Just don't want to get busted, right?
Don't get busted, baby.
Yeah, the interesting with the games being called this year, Amazon Prime takes over for the NFL games, not this Thursday because NBC gets that. And by the way, Mike Tirico takes over calling the games for NBC as Al Michaels transitions over to Amazon Prime. So it's going to be, the games are going to be streaming starting a week from Thursday and throughout all the Thursdays during the season. He's going to be joined by Kirk Herbstreit, who becomes one of the busiest men in football. Kirk is a longtime college football par excellence. No one knows the game of college football better, and he's on College Game Day on ESPN, has been on there for years, and now he becomes the right-hand man to Al Michaels. And we've also got, it's interesting, I noted there are 9 games in the first week that pit quarterbacks taken in the first round of the NFL draft against each other. So the NFL always figures out a lot of good plots, Bob, for that opening weekend to hook people right in. I know, by the way, I've already had my NFL fantasy draft. I took Derrick Henry with my first pick, and I've got Justin Herbert, the quarterback for the LA Chargers. Excited to get this season going. And if for fantasy players, it just gets bigger and bigger.
Well, fantasy football is exploded, led by the NFL. I mean, more participants are involved in fantasy football than you could even imagine. It's a number one sport bet on in the United States. Yep. And I think it's only going to continue to grow. And if your Cincinnati pick holds out, I'll be the first to be on the phone to call you for next week's pick.
And if it doesn't work out, you will also be, I will also
I
be the first on your
you
phone
anymore.
Too. Well, that's a very good point. College football, I don't know how much you had a chance to watch it. Man, there were some crazy games. I don't think I've ever seen a crazier finish than the one last night, Monday night, as we record, or Sunday night, as we record this on Monday, Labor Day, with Florida State blocking an extra point to hold on somehow and beat LSU in Brian Kelly's debut at the Superdome. And some crazy games. Iowa scored 7 points in their victory over the weekend, but they did not score a touchdown, Bob. They had a field goal and 2 safeties. Conversely, in the fourth quarter of the Appalachian State-North Carolina game, the two teams combined for 62 points in the final quarter of the game, and it sounded like a basketball score final of 63-61 with North Carolina. But a couple of impressions coming out of it. Anthony Richardson in Florida look really good. Their victory over Utah was huge for them and first-year coach Billy Napier. Georgia, though, wow, did they ever look dominant. They beat the living you-know-what out of Oregon. I did not see that considering how many players Georgia had lost to the NFL draft, but they're starting to replenish their program, much like Alabama has done for years. So at some point, we're going to see Alabama and Georgia probably among the final four for the college football playoff, which I think it's good. It's now going to be expanded to 12 teams starting in as soon as 2024, and all of the Power Five conferences will be represented. I think that's a good thing. That it makes a lot of sense to go beyond the four. It's a big jump to 12, but they have some home field games early on, and more and more college football, they're playing almost as many games as NFL teams are now, Bob.
Yeah, you're right. And the game I got the biggest kick out of was that North Carolina and Appalachian State 63-61, as you said. Happened to be friends of Mac Brown when he was at the University of Texas. Real good guy, but he was so happy after this victory. I mean, they should have rolled over Appalachian State by 20 or 30 points, but they got a 2-point victory, and Mac was smiling away because it certainly was a weird game, but nothing weird about that special guest that we're going to have coming up. Because Dick Stockton, wow, when you say that name, you're talking par excellence.
And so many games, so many NFL games over the years for NBC, CBS, and Fox Dick Stockton also was the guy who called Carlton Fisk's dramatic game-winning home run in Game 6 of the 1975 World Series when the Red Sox beat the Reds. He's just so good, and he was a mainstay for years and years. Really, really excited to hear from Dick Stockton. I know he has a tremendous amount of stories to share, and we're going to be hearing from Dick Stockton in just a little bit. As a matter of fact, we're going to hear from him right after this message from our good friends at Titleist.
Your most important shot is the one you're about to hit. And whether it's the first drive of the day, a difficult approach from a tight lie, or a bunker shot to save par, you need to know your golf ball will perform exactly the way you need it to. Superior performance on every type of shot. It's why the majority of the world's best players choose the Pro V1 or Pro V1X, and why you should too.
Welcome back to Musings on Sports. Bob, we're delighted to be joined by one of the greatest sports broadcasters of all time. He called one of the biggest home runs in baseball history. He was inducted into the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame as a broadcaster. And boy, did you ever hear his voice calling NFL games for decades on NBC, CBS, and Fox. What a pleasure it is to welcome the great Dick Stockton to Musings on Sports. How are you, Dick?
No, I'm doing great, guys, and thank you very much, Kelly and Bob, for having me on today. I retired a year and a half ago, and I've been enjoying life, traveling, reading, playing the piano, which is my hobby, and still play golf, tennis, and I work out, but I don't need to be busy all the time, and I've been very lucky that I don't have to be doing something, and I can just chill, and I'm happy doing that, keeping up with what's going on in sports. I don't miss doing the games. I love doing it when I did. I appreciate the things I covered and the people I work with, and I'm really happy at this stage.
Well, we're very happy to have you with us on Musings. And Dick, you, growing up in Philadelphia, did you always want to be a sports broadcaster? And who were the broadcasters and other media members who may have caught your attention?
I was born in Philadelphia, but I grew up in Queens, New York, and that's where I spent most of my youth. I knew I wanted to be a sports writer when I was 8 years old. My father would bring home as many as 8 newspapers a day from the New York metropolitan area. Writing was my goal, and so we would analyze the beat writers and how the different beat writers, say from the New York Times and the New York Daily News, would cover a Giants baseball game, and the Giants were our team. I did listen and watch all the games, and so I did really admire. I was so fortunate to grow up in that era where there were three teams in the New York area, and the Giants, Russ Hodges, and Ernie Harwell. Harwell left quickly and left for Baltimore, and then on to Detroit, where he really had an incredible career, and Bob Delaney replaced him, but Russ Hodges was the main voice of the New York Giants, and Red Barber, Vin Scully on the Dodgers, and Mel Allen on the Yankees. You couldn't go wrong. So, and Artie Glickman was doing the Giants in college basketball. So while I wanted to be a sports writer, I had the blessing of hearing the great sportscasters as well.
You arrive in Boston in 71. You began calling Celtics games on TV and became the lead announcer for the Red Sox. What was it like being in that era, in that market, with so many well-known sports figures?
Yeah, that was a great market. Now, I started my career actually in Philadelphia with Group W, Westinghouse Broadcasting, at KYW, when they went all news, and I was the all-night newscaster, and I would do 30 minutes of news at midnight, 2, 4, and 6 a.m., And then I auditioned, and I was able to do the weekend sportscast on the news shows on the weekend, and then moved to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And that was a big time for me, going to KDKA, where I was the sports director there for 4 years. And that's where I met the Rooney family of the Pittsburgh Steelers and became very close to Dan Rooney. And then that started my connection with CBS, doing pre- and post-game shows part-time. And, that was the beginning of that part. And then I continued doing the sports cast on the news shows in Boston when I went to WBZ, and that's the time that you're talking about, and they had a package of 20 Celtics games, and they had me do them as the sports director, and I worked with Bob Cousy, who I talked to last year. He's in his 90s, a marvelous man, one of many former Celtics that I worked with, and of course, you know, Boston was known for, you know, hockey, and Bob Wilson was the play-by-play announcer for the Bruins. Johnny Most was the radio voice of the Celtics. And then I went to New York and freelance because they had the Red Sox package for 20 games, and I just wanted to do a couple of weekend innings, and they just said no, so I left. And I went to freelance in New York, worked for HBO when it began, and then came back in 1975 after Gene Kirby, who was the assistant general manager for Dick O'Connell with the Red Sox. So during 1974, when I was in New York, I was making tapes for him, and I had to do several before he kind of said, you're ready to become a broadcaster with us. They switched to a UHF station, WSBK. We did 100 games a year, and it all started with Hawk Harrelson in 1975, and I had four glorious years with the Red Sox.
Hey, Dick, what was Johnny Most like? I was a big fan of his, and I really enjoyed his work.
He was a marvelous guy. He was a crusty guy, and in fact, you could say he had a crusty voice as well. But he was a marvelous. The Boston fans loved hearing Johnny Most doing a game, and in those days, I mean, Red Auerbach, who became almost a second father to me, insisted that if you're going to do the Celtics games, you're going to be a homer outright. So any official's call always hurt the Celtics. The Celtics were always called for the wrong foul, and the other team, that was okay. And that's the way he worked, and Tommy Heinsohn later on, and that's what he wanted. But that's what the Boston fans wanted in those days. Today, you know, a local critic would say, wait a second, you're not objective. But Red knew what he wanted, and of course the Celtics had great success. So Johnny Most was a terrific guy, and I got to know him, of course, on road trips when I did the games as well.
Let me ask you this, Dick. The NBA, when you started, it certainly is a far cry from what the NBA is now. I mean, it's a worldwide event, and I don't think it was that way back when your initial days. Do you marvel at the growth of the NBA?
Yeah, I do. And the thing is that we never, when I took over as the lead sportscaster, the lead play-by-play man for the NBA in the 81-82 season, they did not have tape delay then. I mean, that was out in 1980. So that was something that was prominent and talked about later on. I think what happened when in our first year of doing the NBA, and I worked with Bill Russell, I know we're going to be talking about him because he's a special guy, but in the years that I started, they reduced for a while the schedule of only one game a month. And so with the rise of Julius Erving and Larry Bird and one game a month, what they did was a masterstroke. In cooperation with the NBA, CBS would see one game a month. And what happened in that case was it created a supply and demand. It created demand. We would show Julius Erving and Larry Bird, and then we'll say, see you next month. And people said, why can't we fix it the next week? So that automatically started the rise in the ratings of the NBA, and it took off from there. But the game reached international proportions while I was still doing him in the magic decade of the 80s, I think.
You mentioned the name, the great Bill Russell, who you worked with on some of those CBS games. What was Bill like off the mic?
Oh, he was a tremendous, decent, down-to-earth guy, no BS, sized up people quickly and accurately. He was a great friend. I know there was an occasion he met my parents. He was funny. We talked a lot about the job. He played enough, and he didn't seem to be really impressed by the players anymore. You know, today they all want to jump in and do it. I don't think it was a passion of him is to do it, but it was great having him on the air. He was, to me, the greatest individual champion of all team sports, winning 11 of 13 titles, starting in the 50s and then being the player coach for 2 years. But when I was growing up in the 50s, I used to watch the Celtics on TV when I was a kid, and they were dominating. And whoever thought that the time would come after watching these guys on Sunday on ABC that someday I'd be working with Bill Russell and Bob Cousy and knowing Red Auerbach and working several years with Bob, with Tommy Heinsohn. So that was one of the great thrills of my career.
Well, we're so pleased to be joined by the great Dick Stockton on Musings on Sports. And Dick, your famous call of If It Stays Fair on Pudge Fisk's dramatic game-winning home run, bottom of the 12th inning, 1975 World Series Game 6, is a call that will that lives on and certainly is a very favorite call for the New Englanders. But there was an interesting backstory in how it was you who came to be calling the 12th inning on NBC Sports in that game.
Yeah, it really is, and it wouldn't happen today, I guarantee you. We had several rainouts prior to the sixth game, and the Reds were leading in the World Series 3-2, and game six scheduled for Fenway Park. And after a nor'easter came in, the game kept on being postponed for several days. And finally, they played it. And before the game, because it was a game in which the Reds could actually wrap up the World Series, Carl Lindemann, Chet Simmons of NBC said, I know normally we start, I was representing the Red Sox in those games. They had team representatives on the broadcast along with Kirk Gowdy, Joe Garagiola, and Tony Kubek. They said, normally, we would have our NBC staff announcer start the game for 4.5, and you would do the play-by-play the last half of the game. But today, because the Reds can clinch it, we would like you to start the game and do 4.5 innings. And then Joe Garagiola, who was at the mic for the play-by-play, Gowdy was on radio for that game. We would like him to have his voice when the Reds clinch it, if that's the case. And I said, you can do whatever you want. I'm happy with it. And so it worked out that way. But then after 9 innings, the game is tied, and we didn't have no idea what was going to happen. And they made the decision, okay, let's just continue to rotate and go back and forth. Dick, you'll do 10. Joe will do 11, and we'll go from there. And,
yeah.
And I happen to win the lottery and have that 12th inning, although there was exciting plays leading up to that 12th inning, as many fans remember. And I happen to be lucky to do it. And that would never happen today because the lead play-by-play announcer would say, okay, thank you, Dick. I'm taking over for the rest of this game, no matter how it goes. It would never happen today. So I was fortunate.
Yeah, I was going to say, a little bit of a stroke of good luck, right?
Yeah, I mean, it turned out that way. And at the time, you don't think anything of it. I know, people always look in retrospect as to what that home run meant, but it wasn't like, wow, this is going to set me up for something. And I never looked at sports broadcasting that way. I never looked at what it meant for me to do it, ever. But, it just meant, okay, we're in the sixth game of this World Series, and now I'm doing the tenth, and we'll see what happens. So it was, we just took it in stride. It wasn't anything that I said, wow, look at me doing, the tenth inning, how lucky I am. As it turned out, looking back, I sure was fortunate.
Yeah, you were. And, you also, it seemed to me, followed the motto of the least said, the better. I noted there were about 35, 36 seconds that you stayed quiet after Pudge rounded the bases, complete bedlam at Fenway, before you said a word. And I think you said something to the effect of there will be a game 7. It reminded me very much of the extended silence of Mr. Scully after Kirk Gibson's memorable home run in game 1 over the A's at Dodger Stadium. Is that the announcer's way? Is that your way of sort of getting out of the way of the moment and allowing the moment to tell the story?
Well, I just did the whole thing by instinct. When I made the call of the home run, for State Fair, home run, because that was all instinctive. And then what is better than the sounds from the field and the pictures that the director shows, how he cuts it, and seeing the fans come on the field and seeing Pudge round the bases with his arms stretched, raised up, and what words are better? And a lot of people, Scully, of course, did that his whole career, and others have done it too. I didn't invent it, neither did he, but nothing is better than the sounds and pictures on television now we're talking about of an event like this. And so it was just instinctive to just keep quiet. What was I going to say that was going to enhance the moment any more than keeping quiet?
Hey, Dick, you excelled in calling, you know, baseball, football, basketball. Which sport did you enjoy calling the most?
You know, I didn't rate any of it. I enjoyed whatever I was doing at the time, whether it would be an Olympics or whether it would be a minor sport, or whether it would be gymnastics or whether it would be skiing. It didn't matter to me. I just liked whatever I was doing at the time. So I didn't, I never really, you know, put it in a classification of, gee, I'm glad I'm doing a football. I did grow up as a baseball fan. And in the 50s, baseball was really the main sport. The other sports were fillers. I mean, hockey, basketball, and even NFL, just fillers between baseball seasons. So I grew up with baseball being number one. But when I did all the sports, you just had an assignment of doing whatever you had, you know, in front of you. So I never really said I'd rather do one than the other.
I know our listeners will be interested in your response to this. Can you give an example of the biggest changes in broadcasting today versus when you started?
Well, obviously, the production element of the game, you know, is at a level now that is superior. I mean, the coverage is better. There are more cameras covering games now. The graphics, maybe there are too many of those, and I think there are. That's the production way of talking too much. It's when they overload you with graphics on the air. That means they're talking too much. But the angles of coverage, the sound from the field, years ago, of course, it was a Spartan coverage. We were fewer cameras. The announcing hasn't really changed, but the production has, and it's gotten much better. There's no question about it.
Yeah, and you know, you're right, Dick. The production at every level. I mean, you watch any big-time college game, and the production level. I was watching the game the other night between Florida State and LSU, and it came down. It was some crazy stuff that happened in the last couple of minutes, and just all the different angles that they had. But I think as viewers, you get used to that. As an announcer, you obviously have to be aware that the viewer is pretty darn sophisticated because of all those camera angles and because of all the knowledge that they have built in as fans.
Yeah, there's no question about it, and they're more knowledgeable because of all of these things. I still think that there's nothing better than to cover the drama on the field. I think that when they roll in a tape of a previous game in a crucial moment late in the game, that takes something away from it. Sure, it's a fact. Don't forget what happened 2 years ago. But what's happening right now? What is the reaction of the field? Mm-hmm. What are the coaches thinking right now? I'd rather deal with the right now more than continually going back and bringing up, rolling in tapes of the past.
You know, in listening to all that you accomplished in your career, the word versatility just keeps popping to mind. And you had the good fortune when CBS had the rights to the Winter Olympics to do some figure skating coverage or some speed skating coverage. Tell me, when you hear the names Dan Jansen, you hear the name Bonnie Blair, and good fortune of being able to call those special moments in Olympic history. What was that like as a versatile announcer to be able to go from the football fields to the speed skating rink and be able to communicate those stories effectively?
Yeah, that's a good question, Kelly. And I'll tell you, when you are covering any sport, you are a reporter. And that's what I always wanted to be, as a reporter. So you could be a news reporter covering a fire. You could be covering a political convention, or you could be a sportscaster covering a sport that you don't normally see. But what you do is that you jump in, and as a reporter, you learn about the speed skating event. What is it's still journalism, but it always goes back to that, you know, the who, what, where, why, when, and how. Dan Jansen going for an elusive gold medal, something he hasn't been able to do because of misfortune in previous Olympics. This is where he is right now. So that's the drama leading up to it, and you call it that way. and you cover it that way, and you learn about what speed skating is. You don't have to be an expert. I had the greatest expert of all, Eric Heiden, who won 5 gold medals in 1980 in speed skating. So you don't have to be an expert to know how they do it. I have to be the reporter.
Speaking of as a reporter, so many years covering the NFL, as I mentioned, starting with NBC and then through the years at CBS and then Fox, there have to be for you some memorable games that stand out, and you certainly had quite the array of broadcast partners over the years, Dick.
Well, I did, and the key was I wasn't the lead broadcaster working with the same guy for 16 years, so I had different partners there, and you know the games were great. I did 6 Super Bowl World feeds that weren't seen in this country but around the world, and so there were a lot of great games and a lot of games that were just games, but I loved covering them no matter what they were. But to work with the likes of Roger Staubach and John Madden and Dan Fouts and Hank Stram, and even Wayne Walker, you know, who wasn't as prominent, but a great linebacker and a great guy. And then going to Fox and having Matt Millen for 8 years and John Lynch, the current general manager of the 49ers, and finishing with Mark Schlereth. They broke in all of the Fox announcers from Troy Aikman, Darryl Johnson, and I worked with, Chris Spielman as well and others. That was the excitement because you got to know these guys for the entire weekend. The coaches and players, you see, they go and they do and they play the game, but you're with those other people and you see them in a different angle. And I thought that was one of the great exciting points of my career. You know, the final game was 2020 and they put Matt Millen back with me. So my last game, ironically, was with Matt Millen, and ironically more so, it was the Texans at the Browns, and Deshaun Watson was quarterbacking for Houston against the Cleveland Browns. And we go on with that story.
Talk about irony, exactly. Hey, if you would, real quick, when it comes to the announcing duo for a network broadcast of the NFL, when does your week with that partner begin, and what are your responsibilities? I know you meet with both coaches. What's the time frame on that, Dick?
Well, that's good. During the week, we just prepare our way. I like to know. You know, like we get oodles and oodles of biographical information, statistics. I don't like statistics. They're for graphics, and they can be overdone as well. But in telling stories about guys, I don't have time to do it. My job is to call the game, call it right, and let the other guy take over and say whatever he wants to say. But so we got there on a Friday, or we did. It's changed now because of the COVID situation, and now everything is done by Zoom. So no one goes to the training camp or to the practice anymore. But we did for decades. We went to Friday practice, watched the practice, which was meaningless to me because they pass and throw. It didn't mean anything. But then we would sit down with the head coach, a coordinator, and a couple of players, and then have a production dinner on Friday. Saturday, we would be in our meeting room. The visiting team would come to their hotel, and we would meet with them the same manner, and then Sunday would be the game. And that's the routine we did. There was a lot of maybe over preparation because I know the guys who do radio broadcasts of NFL come in Saturday night. They have a dinner with their buddies, and they do the game on Sunday, and they do a tremendous job. So I think that over preparation can hurt you. And I don't know anyone who is underprepared anymore. Everyone is when they do a game. But sometimes you can overprepare, which means you're going to talk too much.
Well, Dick, what I've decided after listening to you, and I've thoroughly enjoyed this interview, and I know our listeners are going to be, if somebody said, who'd you have on, I'm going to say, Dick, voice of sports, Stockton.
Thank you, Bob. That's nice to be. There are many of those out there, believe me.
Hey, Dick, before we let you go, how about a best piece of advice that someone maybe as a mentor to you when you got going in the business offered to you in terms of sports broadcasting, and any advice that you might offer someone today who's looking to pursue that profession? It's a very different profession today than it was when you started.
Well, it's different, and there are two aspects to it. Number one are the talk shows on television and radio that deal with you know, what's happening today, who's calling plays for the Patriots, is it Patricia, is it Judge, you know, and all that stuff. They have to fill the time. I don't listen to any of those things because, you know, it's just gibberish, in my view. I'm not saying that the fans don't like it. They do. So, but I'm telling you my view. What I would tell, you know, a potential play-by-play announcer is don't talk all the time. In fact, I was watching a sporting event, you know, the other day, and an event was going on, and the two announcers were having a conversation about something and about some statistical thing. And that's why the mute button, you know, that was our biggest enemy, was the mute button. They turn that, you know, they press the right button, they don't get to hear. And I know a lot of friends of mine, they do that, and they can see what's happening on the field. So if you just let the game, people are tuning in for the game. Now, I'm talking about game coverage. I'm not talking about shows where you have personalities, where they want to hear what a certain guy has to say. But the game is what people are tuning in for. Many times they don't even know who the broadcasters are going to be. So just give them what they need. Don't try to be funny, because you're not funny. The audience doesn't want that. Tell them what they need. Don't overload them with too much information, because they'll tune you out. And just say what needs to be said, and let your expert take over and give his view on what happened, because he has been down there. He knows what happened. You're the reporter. You set it up. Let him go, but keep it concise.
How about a great piece of advice that you may have been offered when you first started in the business?
I didn't get any one piece of advice. I was so blessed to have the likes of Kurt Gowdy and Lindsey Nelson talk to me about broadcasting, and I just watched what they did, and I absorbed what they did. And it wasn't so much advice, but just being around them, see the way they handle themselves, see the way they handle the assignments. You know, that was a tremendous boost for me watching. And then you have to make a decision. What do you want to be as a play-by-play man? Do you want to be a personality, or do you want to call the game? Do you want to be known? If that's what you want to do, then go ahead and do what you want to do. I never cared about being known or being talked about or being saved that he's on. Look, if people, you know, say that they admired what I did in my career, I like that. All I wanted to do was make the game or enhance the game for the viewer who worked all week and now had a chance to just relax in front of his TV, to have a beer, to have some chicken wings on a Sunday, enhance it for him without getting in the way. That was my goal.
Well, Dick, one thing along those lines, I have been a big proponent in any broadcasting that I do, and primarily it's been golf over the years. But I always felt very strongly that less was far better than more. In other words, as you say, let the story be the story. It's no different than being an official. If you're an official, you don't want people to know your name.
I totally agree. And, Bob, I'll say something, that in your sport, golf, people are talking too much now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let the players tell the story.
I remember the great Frank Turkinian. And if you talk while the ball was in the air, you're out. You aren't going to have a job. And you let the ball land. And it's the ridiculous no kidding stuff, you know, where a guy is making getting ready for a 20-foot putt and would take the lead if he makes it, and the announcer says, boy, he really would love to make this putt and have a lead going into 17. You know? You think?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you think?
Captain Obvious, right?
Yeah, right.
You have enhanced the game for so many years, so many viewers and listeners for so many years, and you've enhanced Musings on Sports with your presence today. Cannot thank you enough for your time and your thoughts and hearing all the names, you know, Russ Hodges and Mel Allen and Mr. Scully and Lindsey Nelson and Johnny Most. I mean, you were fantastic in what you did, and how glorious it must have been to have been associated with all those incredible people.
Well, Kelly and Bob, thanks for having me on, and it's really a dream. I mean, I was just a kid in Queens growing up watching my New York Giants play at the Polo Grounds and watching other games and other sports, and to say that someday you're going to be, you know, in that same arena was really a tremendous blessing to me. I'm very grateful for it.
Today, there are smarter phones, smarter cars, smarter everything. So Bridgestone Golf's engineers thought, why not a smarter golf ball? Introducing the new Tour B, with a smart reactive IQ cover that delivers more power off your driver, more control off your wedges. Try Bridgestone's new Tour B with reactive IQ cover, the smarter tour ball.
Well, Bob, great to hear from Dick Stockton. Such a versatile guy. You know, his roots in Boston, where he was, you know, the voice for WBZ for a number of years, and then he went national. And he's been in our homes now, or he was in our homes for, oh my gosh, 40, 50 years.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. Multi-talented. It's one thing to be a good football announcer. Another thing, yeah, maybe be great at baseball games or the NBA. Dick Stockton had the talent to, you know, just tap dance between sports. You didn't know there was any drop down in knowledge of whatever sport he was broadcasting. A true legend, and we certainly appreciated the time that he gave us, and I know our listeners of Musings had to enjoy that conversation with Dick Stockton.
Well, versatility is the word. And our guest next week, Bill McAtee, long time with CBS Sports and USA Network, and I believe Bill was with NBC for a while as well, is going to be joining us. Very versatile guy, and I think that's why the careers of so many broadcasters are extended, because they can do so many different things so well. Speaking of doing things well, Bob Bupka, get back to the table. Get those winnings up. Put that little bit of cheese on the Bengals for this weekend. And call me and tell me how great a prognosticator I am, because I am Kelly Elbin, signing off for Bob Bupka. On Musings on Sports, you can hear us on all of the platforms for podcasts, as well as Morning Read. Look forward to talking to you next week on Musings on Sports.